Today is Thursday. It's April 25th, 2019. It's 11:14 in the morning. Hi, I'm John Williams. This is The Mincing Rascals, a weekly podcast we record at the studios of WGN Radio in Chicago. We really appreciate your tuning in. Share this podcast with your friends. You can hear me weekdays from 1 to 3, Steve Bertrand.
Share it with your enemies. Just share it. I'm Steve Bertrand, host of the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN.
Scott Stantis, editorial cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune and creator of the comic strip Prickly City. And Eric, you always interrupt my
introduction
when I'm just getting to the good part. You always do that, Eric.
Host of the Prickly City podcast.
And yes, right here on WGN Plus.
I'm Eric Zorn. I'm Eric Zorn, the returning champion of the Mincing Rascals, and I'm in the newspapers Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays.
Who are Chicago columnists for 200, Alex.
Exactly, yeah. You're aping James Holzhauer.
Is that a cool story or what? That guy. I've been actually now DVRing that Jeopardy just to watch him run through his opponents.
John has become good friends with his brother, who's been on the show.
He's a Naperville attorney and said he was a terrible student. The brother, the brilliant one on Jeopardy.
Yeah.
He didn't get good grades, didn't care, whatever. He's the guy that would show up for the final and ace it, one of those guys. And so, but you know, if I just may start off on the tangent that Eric always takes us on. So if you have a brain that is that nimble, that's that good at those sorts of things, what do you do? You know, do you become a doctor? Do you become a scientist? Do you become a politician and help the world? He's in Vegas as a sports betting guy. That sounds critical and judgmental. He's getting rich. It's a living. But I'm more intrigued than I am critical of his chosen occupation. If you have that much brain power, what should you do with this gift? And he's in Vegas.
My son is really, really good in math, and he's in Manhattan in finance, not solving the great math problems of the world. And I have a hard time sitting in judgment of what someone does with their talent.
I don't know. You're not being critical of somebody who's in finance, are you? I mean,
no, I'm just
maybe
saying
that helps,
but he's not using it for the world good.
But maybe is. Who's to say that? I mean, depending on what he's doing.
Well, I hope he starts a charitable foundation for ancient journalists, man.
Right.
I, for one, am a math agnostic. I don't believe math exists. So I was always terrible at it and loathed it in school. And here I am in the newspaper business. So.
Well, if you've been watching Veep, you see one of the themes is that math is actually a Muslim plot. It's a terrorist thing. because it was invented, yes. It was invented by Arabs.
I love that show.
Me too.
We will talk about Game of Thrones on the podcast today.
We will.
It didn't come up
I
in the meeting.
I did not get the note on that.
Well, that's what they call the governor's story about removing the toilets.
Oh.
From I love the headlines. Game of Thrones.
I thought I was in deep doo-doo there for a second.
The governor removed toilets from his mansion, and he's still having to pay the political price for that. Before we do any of that, the body of 5-year-old A.J. Friend was found Wednesday, 1 week after the Crystal Lake boy went missing. His parents have been charged with the murder. Standing here today, we do not know the cause of the boy's death. DCFS and police know this family well, though. The boy was born with opiates in his system, removed from his parents' home at birth. Their home was described as having broken windows, busted kitchen floor, dog feces, and urine throughout. DCFS says they will do a transparent review to, quote, understand our shortcomings in the handling of the case. This is an opportunity for the new governor to step up and demand more resources put into the care of kids like AJ. And perhaps the laws should be looked at to tip the scales more in these children's favor. AJ should have been in the foster system, not in Crystal Lake. This is not DCFS's fault, but it is their problem to fix. It's the state's problem to fix.
Well, I do agree with that. Certainly the role of opioids in this story is telling. And the fact that I don't know that there's monthly drug tests or how they handle this when a child is returned to parents after a situation like that. That's really troubling. And all the stories you hear about the condition of the house, it's not necessarily simple just to take a kid out of a house and find a suitable place for that kid to be. I'm not sure that it's always in the, if you've got a house that's filthy like that, if it's always in the best interest of the child to do that, to move a child out. Obviously, in this case, you look back and think, well, you know, clearly they should have done that. But you do need more resources. This family, you can imagine being like a caseworker going and seeing the condition of this house. And not doing anything about it, saying, "Oh well, the kids." I think some of the reports I've seen said that he seemed happy. right?
And the police were there, and the police took the kids out once and talked to them about it and weren't overly alarmed. I mean, it's not just DCFS.
But one time they came to the door and they were not allowed in. The boy had bruises on his body that he attributed to the family dog. I don't know what kind of dog they had, but that sounds really odd to me. The dog bruised the boy. When a dog jumps on you, they might scratch your leg, but bruised the boy's thigh?
This was problematic. Bruce Dold, who's now the editor and publisher of the Chicago Tribune, won a Pulitzer many years ago, along a similar story. A kid had been removed from a house. The mother was clearly had profound mental issues. He was returned, and she killed him. And we've had another case, which my mind can't remember recently.
The kid found under the sofa?
That was in Joliet.
Yes, in Joliet. So here's the thing. DFS is faced with these remarkably horrible situations, and they're incredibly underfunded. They're incredibly understaffed. They have turnover like you wouldn't believe. And I think these are the types of things that even a knuckle-dragging conservative like myself can say, this is the purview of government. This is the proper use of government. And the fact is they don't have the resources to patrol this stuff, and these type of things are going to happen.
I don't know the answer to this question, but whether this was an example of not enough resources, if they didn't have enough money to pay people to go to that house enough, or that when you go to the house and you see what's going on, the laws are not in place, the practices aren't in place to take a child out. No matter how many if you throw a lot of resources at something, if the practices remain the same, you could have someone from DCFS visiting there every day, but if what they see is okay by them,
or insufficient,
then
what do you mean?
Well, it could be not okay by them, but it's like not sufficient to trigger removal of the child.
Right. I mean, you can imagine a house with say, broken windows, right? I mean, a house gets a broken window and the parents can't afford to fix it. Have they boarded it up? Have they? You know, but when you have a child living in filth and the law says, well, a little filth, who hasn't lived in filth? And they let them go. That's not a resource question. That's a legal question,
policy,
I believe, a policy question. And I think, if this transparent review that they're promising reveals that, then maybe some laws need to be changed.
I agree with you on that. And I think the danger that they'll weigh their actions against is, well, what about the instance where we take a kid out of a home? You know, that's dire. Really, the state should not separate families that way. And we put it into a foster care home, and it's bad in the foster system. By the way, that's no panacea.
Right, and we've written about that.
I'm willing to take the risk. If you said, okay, roll the dice, I'm going to go with the system. I mean, at least its motives are good, for crying out loud.
I think part of the role that DCFS plays in these situations is to work with the families to improve the situations that they deal with, to clean up the house, or what resources do they need? Do they need drug treatment? That kind of thing.
This is a terrible situation and tragic story, but I don't mean batting average, but we only hear about the massive failures of DCFS, and I wonder if this massive failure, if it is on behalf of DCFS, how it measures against the 1,000 success stories that they have, or the 332 success stories that they have. I don't know what that ratio is.
Okay, Steve, but go ahead.
I wish I knew that. And
Let's say 99% of the time they're right. This is not a critique of DCFS, right? I mean, I think it's a critique of the law. I think that the law should allow them to be more heavy-handed. They should call me, King John. I'll walk in and go, yeah, the kid's out. Come back in a year. I mean, really, I would have no trouble making a snap judgment in that case. So number one. And number two, I think we should, throw more money at the problem. Pay those people more. A woman called in who'd been in doing this for a while, and I said, how much do you get paid? And she said, by the way, I'm supposed to have 15 cases active, but people quit. They get burnt out. They walk away from their jobs. And so now I have 25. I have 25 cases. She sounded exhausted. She's getting $40,000 a year. I don't know if that sounds like a lot to you, but I'd pay that lady $70,000
And I'm guessing that when she goes into the houses that she goes to and visits the families, she's not always welcomed with a plate of cookies and a little pot of tea.
And she's got to write reports.
These are often very there's conflict in these relationships, and sometimes they can't carry any weapons. They can't carry mace.
That's true. They can't even come in with protection like that for themselves.
I mean, I agree with you. I think it's a very tough job. Patty Vasquez is here. What does she think?
She's up pretty late, and now she's in pretty early. How are you, Patty?
when the budget crisis hit, I wondered how many people would suffer and how many kids or those with disabilities would fall through the cracks. I'm not sure if that's something that you guys have talked about, but they are underpaid. They are unwelcomed in many situations. And the DCFS has been under attack for a lot of issues over the last few years. It's been mismanaged. I mean, do you remember when they were like offering gift cards for, you know, certain cases that were closed and
right.
things like that?
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah. I mean, they don't seem to know. And look, it's a vast problem that we wish. And you mentioned throwing money at it. And then, you know, we have a lot of listeners who are like, well, why should I have to pay for that? You know, why do I got to,
you know,
I said that
yesterday.
My taxes?
I said, well, let's put on your tax bill how much it is.
What do you mean?
All these people who want to spend more money and say that the state should be doing more. Okay, so when you pay your taxes in April, let's say that $150 goes toward, another $150 goes toward DCFS. We'll see how many people want to do it then, because I bet there won't be many.
Talk about how you would do that, Steve. Is that a state income tax you're talking
well,
about?
Well, I wouldn't really do it. My point is,
I don't think you shouldn't.
I'm going to choose my words badly here, but I'm uncomfortable with this whole story and the way we're talking about this whole story. And I'm, you know, I could easily say that if this happened to a 5-year-old kid on the West Side, we wouldn't be doing this. We wouldn't be breaking into live coverage, you know, of news conferences. We just wouldn't. And I'm struck by how much time we're spending on this story. And I don't want to sound callous, but because I don't understand my own feelings about it, but I don't like it. And part of it is I think that it's, and if you listen to the radio, God bless callers, that's what we do. It's just, it's giving us all something to gossip about. I think there's been a lot of like back fence gossiping. Well, I know this person who does this, and well, you know, this person does that. And I'm just not comfortable by it. I feel like there's some level of, not enjoyment, but we're this release of being able to gossip about other people who aren't like us. And I just don't like
you know,
that.
As you mentioned this, and you say, if this were a child on the West Side, would CNN have been covering it? Would we be breaking into newscasts?
CNN did.
Does CNN covers this case?
Yeah.
I'm saying they're covering this case, but if it were a kid on the West Side
Would local TV? I mean,
okay, well, anybody, the answer is no.
The answer is no. Because he's a white kid?
Well, in Crystal Lake. I think it's Crystal Lake.
Crystal Lake is not... You know, I mean, it's not...
It's not Winnetka.
Winnetka, yeah.
I know, but it has a reputation to be. It has a reputation that it might be. We're associated more like that. I don't know. I really don't know, but I just feel like enough. This is a tragic story. It's the parents who are charged with killing him, not the state. These parents who are accused of doing terrible things. And I just feel like somehow we're getting... I don't want to say enjoyment out of it because that's the wrong word, or relief, but a lot of us are just gossiping about it, and it's just, I don't like it.
But it is an opportunity, though, to look at the system and to seek ways that it can reform itself, because we don't pay attention to a lot of these everyday cases that this happens to. So when finally one does raise to the surface, for whatever reason, for whatever uncomfortable reason, at least we are talking about this. At least we're talking about the resource issue, the regulations issue. And what went wrong here? If we can figure out what went wrong here, maybe we can save a kid on the West Side or South Side who we'd never hear of either way.
Steve's just mad because I didn't play the 911 phone call all the way through.
Take that back.
what were your thoughts on the 911 call?
I don't like 911 calls.
I don't either.
I don't either.
I'm with Team Bertrand on this.
I was outraged that they released it, and that the Chicago Tribune and Channel 9, well, I don't see it. I don't know if I saw a link on the Tribune, but I was able to listen to the 911 call because Channel 9 posted the call in its entirety. I think that's an incredible invasion, and I also think it invites judgment that we're not qualified to make. People in both newspapers, Sun-Times and Tribune, described the quote-unquote calm voice that the father called in with, and I'm thinking, okay, well, then he must be guilty, right? Because he wasn't hysterical enough. What a misguided path to lead people down. Even if he did do it, looks like he did. But you cannot judge people by their 911 calls, and that's what we do.
Yeah, but this is a news story. You have to post the call.
No, yes, you do. Yes, it's part of the news story. But why is it part of the news story? I have long been, and I've written columns about this in the past, I'm opposed to the airing of 911 calls when there's no probative value to it. If you just want to hear someone in their most hysterical moments, at the worst moment of their lives, most of them. I mean, these people perhaps not so much. But when you have, here's the 911 call when someone discovers their child is dead, right. or here's the 911 call when someone sees someone shot in a school.
Or is being attacked.
If it's the 911 calls from a fire in the county building when we're trying to figure out how emergency services reacted and did it, you know, then that's one thing.
Question of how they responded to those calls.
Right.
Yeah, but if it's just the lurid qualities.
Exactly, I agree.
I don't think you can have one and not the other. You have transparency or you don't.
I don't think the question is one of freedom of information. I mean, I think perhaps it all should be public, but maybe the media shouldn't.
You can take pictures of dead bodies on the street. We don't publish those, and that's...
It also becomes evidence, because, and then we're all like armchair, detectives trying to...
It's a gossip thing. Well, you can tell by the way she sounded.
Well, what's going on in the background? I'm trying to listen to, like, is there anybody upset behind them? And you also, aren't you tainting the jury pool? Because now, for months, as you mentioned, we've been gossiping about it, and then people are going to come in with preconceived ideas about what they heard on that tape, rather than hearing it as evidence in a courtroom.
I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with honest to goodness, I'm a 100% transparency person. I think this is part of the story. This is part of the narrative. You air it.
It just feels voyeuristic. I think that's,
of course, it
again,
is.
The gossip nature of it.
A lot of news is, that's what this is.
But the news has been adopting this pose of responsibility. For instance, in almost all the coverage I saw, the Columbine anniversary, the 20th anniversary last week, they didn't mention the names of the shooters. That the media, and that's certainly public information, it's knowledge, it's easy to find those names, but most of the media coverage did not mention that. We do not mention rape victims' names. That's not a law. That's a practice that we have in the media where we just say, we draw the veil on certain things. We don't report them if we feel like, in those cases, if we feel like there's not a public interest in this. And by interest, I don't mean, I've got the ghoulish interest in hearing somebody when they discover their kid is killed or something on the 911 call. I think that we just use our discretion. That's my thing.
I don't think we should make it illegal.
Oh, absolutely.
I
agree with that. Yeah.
But so, Scott, how does listening to a mom's anguish over a tremendous loss, say, of a child or a husband, or how does that lead toward, what benefit do we have from that transparency? What is transparent about that helps us?
I don't know that you can gauge transparency and its advantages or disadvantages. I think you have a narrative. We have a story. This is part of the story. It's an important part of the story. So you include it. As a journalist, you include it. And so I don't have a problem with that.
It's funny that you're, of the journalists here, the one who doesn't use transcript or audio, you know?
So here I am saying that was terrible, right? And then I thought I'd have my cake and eat it, and I played 5 seconds of it on the radio the other day. Bertrand flipped out. He's screaming at my producer off the air, going, "What is he doing here?" And I said, "Well, I thought I was sampling it so microscopically that I wasn't guilty of what I was accusing, say, Channel 9 of being." But in that clip I played, it was the father, and here he goes, it was the father saying, "We have a missing child here." His phraseology was passive.
Tell me exactly what happened.
We have a missing child.
Right away, people said, if that was your kid, you would say, "My son is missing." You would actually use a different sentence structure. Now it turns out maybe the callers were right as they CSI'd it on the radio. Sure, I felt that he knew or had something to do with the boy's disappearance. Of course we all felt that. I just didn't like using the 911 tape to judge him. Go ahead.
Nope, not going to do it.
Oh, fine enough. So we called the governor out on this just to say, Governor Pritzker, you should be on the radio tomorrow, and you should be talking about the leadership role you're going to take in this. Hopefully the governor will join us today. I heard Elif pleading with his staff in our office today to say he really should get in front of this. And maybe that would be a smart move for him, considering that the same day that we're pleading for more dollars to be put into Child Protective Services, the big story yesterday was the governor's case of the Game of Thrones was the headline.
I'm sorry.
Our billionaire governor.
This is the child. Okay?
To review, our billionaire governor had toilets removed from one of his mansions so as to declare it uninhabitable. There's no working toilets. And thereby reduce its property tax. He's now under federal investigation for that $300,000 tax break on the Gold Coast home. The county inspector general called this a scheme to defraud taxpayers, even though the governor has since repaid the county $330,000 that he would have otherwise paid in property taxes. I don't know that this is an important story, really. Do you?
Well, people voted for him knowing about the Game of Thrones. I'm just not sure what more evidence the FBI needed or the feds needed in order. Is it the FBI that is?
That's so I understand it.
It's the federal.
So, right.
And they're talking about because he's remitted some of his payments by mail, it's mail fraud. They can add mail fraud charges.
What's he supposed to do? Look, he shouldn't have done it. And he did it, and he got caught, and he paid the money back, and people elected him knowing full well that he was the kind of billionaire that does that sort of thing. I don't like one bit of this. I'm willing to put this on the same bus that the Jussie Smollett story is on and just get it out of here and let's move on. I don't understand the importance of it.
You know, I haven't done recent reporting on this, but when it first came out, I talked a lot to then-Assessor Berrios' office about what the practice was and how this is not that uncommon for someone to take a house that they're actually rehabbing. And he was ostensibly rehabbing it and to just pull stuff out of it because you want it declared uninhabitable because you aren't living there. And so so this was within the four corners of the law. Now the question becomes with the Inspector General's report whether he was actually working on a rehab on that house or whether he just pulled the toilets out sort of preemptively. They were going to wait and see what they're going to do because I guess that mansion is just like a buffer for his family. They
right.
just don't want someone living next door to
them. That's right.
That's right.
And it's hinky. There's no question about it. And the idea that, you know, it doesn't jibe well with his whole plan to make the rich pay more in taxes. Like, if you wanted the rich to pay more in taxes, then why'd you take the toilets out of your house, you know, out of your other mansion? I think it looks bad for him, frankly. I mean, I think it's just something that the charges could be filed. I don't think he's going to be frog marched off to prison for it, but he could end up paying a significant fine. He might have to pleading guilty. It could. I don't know.
What does that mean? Well, you're more conversant with this than I. If he's found guilty of a federal offense, does he leave office?
I don't know about. I don't think that a federal crime. Yes, I think a federal crime. You can't be. I think you can't be governor if you're guilty of a federal crime.
I think only presidents can commit federal crimes and not be removed from office.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Honestly, right?
Well,
honestly.
Can't be indicted.
Oh, well, now that you mentioned, well, there it is not the practice of the government to charge and indict convict.
Only the president could commit a federal crime and not be removed from office.
I am not sure that that's even true.
He really can shoot someone in Manhattan.
It may well be
also that he wasn't the quarterback of this whole initiative. I mean, I am guessing he's got a whole lot of stuff going on, and it might be that
JB, you're talking about
MK, yeah, that his wife MK, MK, or that some of the people working with him decided to do this, and they may have mentioned it to him, but he wasn't like rubbing his hands together.
Okay, honestly, I know the story's been going on forever, but I really haven't paid that much attention to it.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is he's got a really big house by his house,
right?
That no one lives in,
right?
Right, and they don't want anyone to live in, and they own it.
And they're going to rehab it,
so
and maybe move into it.
And so, an advisor came to them and said, "You know, no one's going to live in it. You don't want anyone to live in it. So while they're not living in it, if you remove the toilets, we can reduce your tax liability."
Correct.
Yes.
But there were also some kitchen fixtures that were taken out as well.
Well, I would do that too. I'm sorry, I don't quite understand what's. I mean, if I own the property, if no one's going to live in the property, I don't want anyone to live in the property, and I can reduce my tax liability by taking the toilets out, I would do that.
That's an interesting point, especially since you figure if nobody's living there, the non-existent occupants aren't using any city services, right? Ostensibly, taxes are for services that the city delivers to you relative to the value of the home.
And they're still
but there ain't nobody there.
They're still paying on the property, right? They're still paying property taxes, but it's a lesser
but less,
tax.
Far less.
Right. Isn't that taking a write-off the illegal, I mean...
Thank you for that perspective, Steve.
This is what Berrios' office was contending. Now, of course, everyone, Berrios...
don't want him on your team.
But you don't necessarily want him. But they were saying that this was something that happens quite a lot, that someone will buy a house to be rehabbed, and one of the first things they'll do is they'll take things out so that it's not counted as a habitable residence. Now, the question is, how serious was this rehab job? How imminent was it? Were they just doing it? We'll take the toilets out now, and we'll rehab it in a few years. And can you then say that this is tax fraud? I don't know.
I mean, seriously, in my house, there's a house next door. And if I were to buy it because it has a big lot and I wanted to use the backyard but never live in the house.
You'd yank the toilets, too.
Well, I'm asking you. So never do that. And so here you have this empty house that's going to be sitting there empty. And I was told if you took the toilets out, because no one's going to live there anyway, then you would pay less in taxes.
Steve, you've made a compelling argument for tax fraud. I think you make a really good point.
Is that tax fraud?
Well, the question is, you know, we often look at things like if you take this, if you donate this amount of money, you can write off on your tax. We're often told if you do this, then you'll get a tax break, right? I mean, so that's basically what you're breaking it down to, not just if you're rich, but for anybody. You know, you have these tips as to what's going to lower your tax.
I'm really genuinely asking because that's what it looks like to me. I don't quite understand what the...
I think it's kind of moving
anyway.
Other
than he's a gazillionaire and it looks inky because he's a gazillionaire.
Well, I think it's easier to go after people like this for crimes we ourselves would otherwise commit when they go by their first initials, JB and MK. I mean, I don't go around calling my wife BW and she doesn't call me, hey, J-Dub. Even though I guess we couldn't if we were
That'd
sufficiently
be kind of adorable
rich.
She did.
Be kind of sweet if she did.
We're moving on.
Well, okay,
A friend of ours, Mark Baser, has a son who attends Julian Middle School in Oak Park. He told me recently about a controversy at the school. Eric Zorn wrote about it in today's online edition of the Tribune. And it is this, a huge mural hanging in that school in Oak Park titled Child and Sports Winter showed only white children playing in a winter scene. The painting was a 1930s WPA production that put artists to work during the Great Depression, and while it accurately reflected the population of Oak Park then, it does not now represent what the principal called for, a greater sense of inclusion and belonging. So the lovely painting has been taken down. Should it have been removed, Eric Zorn?
It's sort of a Currier and Ives type thing. It's 17 by 6. It's got
17 feet.
Yeah,
by
it's big.
Six
it's a
feet.
Big thing. So you can't really find a museum that's going to say, "Oh, we got space on our wall for that." And it shows. It shows. And I'm not sure it's actually Oak Park. The woman who painted it was a Chicago-born artist. But these artists were not. She was not like recreating an actual scene in Oak Park, but it does reflect Oak Park was 98% white at that point. And so it reflects Oak Park in 1937, basically. And the question is, do you want this painting up in a school that's basically, it's now 52% white, that the Julian School.
Yes.
And the question is, do you want that? And okay, so you have that up there in their lunchroom. Do you want to take that down, or do you want to contextualize it? The easy answer is to take it down, right? Is to put it into storage and say we'll put other paintings up. I think the better answer would be to maybe put a plaque with it explaining what it was. I mean, and the thing is that these WPA murals, and there are thousands of them, tens of thousands of them around the country, they were all painted at a time when the professional classes were all white, when society was far more segregated than it is now. And so you see a lot of sexism and a lot of sort of
racism,
things that make you racially uncomfortable. Some of them even have, like, you know, black people picking cotton and Indians shooting people with arrows. And it's like, it is a different sense of history. I think that
black people did pick cotton and Indians did shoot arrows.
I know they did. That, like, it's just a snapshot. But if you want to have put that into context.
Okay,
In this case, I would leave it up and make it part of my history curriculum, right?
Well, yes.
This is a part of history, a part
Good
of
idea.
American history in your school.
But I think that you needed, my solution to that would have been to have labeled it and to have taught about it.
See, right, right.
This was Oak Park in 1937. Why was Oak Park that way in 1937? How is Oak Park different today? And then have a mural on the other wall showing all the kids in Oak Park today all on their phones.
Well, no, really.
In winter.
But half of whom would be people of color.
I wouldn't even talk about that was Oak Park of then and this is Oak Park of now. I would say this is a WPA painting.
It's about the WPA.
And here's why they did it during the Depression.
Right.
I think that's a part of history that's a shame.
And what does the plaque say? We used to not let black kids come to our school.
I don't think the plaque doesn't have to be censorious.
Well, I think it'd be more artful than that, Patty. I'm not sure those are the words they'd use.
I think you could explain the WPA and explain what these murals
that's
did.
That's so...
And you can,
can we
All right,
just,
let's go. Let's
wait,
defer
wait,
to the artist here.
Artist. I forgot there's an artist.
Yeah, I mean, here's the... why can't you just update the painting?
That's really interesting. You should say that.
Because
I reported on this. I asked some art experts about this. Like, why not just, like, go in there over a weekend and, like, change the color of some of the faces, for goodness sake.
You actually said that,
and they lost their nuts. I couldn't believe
that you did that.
They recalled.
That has got to be the most ridiculous resolution to this story.
Because it's not. Listen to this.
Wow.
The fine artist next to me.
All right, Scott.
I think a compare and contrast sort of, I think, you know, here's where we are now.
I kind of like that idea, but I don't have a problem with, especially a WPA mural, which they're not sacrosanct.
Let's be honest, they're not. Yes, they're interesting.
Public art, that some of them are good, some of them not so much. and go back into it and update the painting, I don't have a problem with this.
Wait a minute. So you're on board with Zorn?
Give
get a little brown paint
and a little, and game, little Game Boys.
Oh my God!
So do we go into like Picasso's and like even out the eyes because it doesn't quite? It's not
put corrective
accurate.
Lenses.
That is different. And no, it is different. I think there's different art in different times and different contexts and sometimes.
All right, but then it's no longer a WPA. It's no longer an historically valuable or relevant work of art. It's now correctionism.
I can actually see the art historian's view, but we don't do that with paintings. But I don't understand why you couldn't contextualize this with other murals. And
I kind of like the idea to tell you the truth because it also gives an artist
I know. Somebody else do a 17 by 6.
How about this? There must be the technology. Why can't you put secret people in there? No, I mean it. And then when people put on
it can be augmented reality.
When people put in glasses, then they see the...
Or their phones, like the Pokemon.
Right.
I think they should put Waldo in there. But Waldo,
are you guys laughing at me? I just thought
these were bad ideas.
Wait, that was a brilliant idea.
As a Lane Tech Indian, our...
the Warriors now. I know. My daughter's a Lane Tech Warrior.
Right. So the hallways are lined with WPAs.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I, now I have to go back and see if there's an accurate portrayal of...
They've got to come down, Patty.
Lane Tech's like, shut up.
New subject, and now there are 26. Biden.
Can I ask, what does Baser think about this?
Baser was really sad when he heard about it. He's going to talk about it on one of our radio shows, I think first part of next week. I'm off. I think he's going to be on my show talking to one of our hosts. I know he was really saddened by it, particularly since the impetus for this was a student committee that presented it to the principal. So it was a small group of middle school students who said, hey, it doesn't look like us. And then the principal made the decision without really involving the parents or a lot of adults. Maybe he would have anyway, but I was a little surprised at how quickly he was to acquiesce, if you will, to the good intentions of the kids, but maybe not the best course of action.
I kind of like the second mural idea, by the way.
Yeah.
I think we're on board that. Mm-hmm. I think Eric's idea about painting the faces brown is reprehensible, however.
I just suggested it to people. I wasn't promoting it.
Hey, we're coming up with our opinions as we talk through them.
And now there are 26. Joe Biden is one. He announced his candidacy this week, and he's ranked number one. Although he hasn't played many games and his strength of schedule is weak. What do you guys think of Joe Biden as the Democratic leader?
Well, clearly, he's got strength in the polls. I think a lot of it is name recognition. I have this feeling, kind of like I do before the NFL draft, which is like there's all this speculation going on, all this jockeying before anything has actually really happened. And it's very difficult to really engage, to look at what his policies are now, take a look at what he did back in the 90s. The big question that I keep hearing asked is a 76-year-old white man the right guy to be carrying the Democratic Party into the future? And the answer seems to be implicit in that question is no.
I don't even have that objective. I think a lot of us are going to vote in the next election with one thing in mind,
right?
And it's not the future of the Democratic Party.
A poll came out today that he's 8 points ahead of Trump already.
really?
Yeah.
If the election were today, but it's not, it's in 2 years.
Well, here's the thing. If the election were held today, I would, my politics, but I would vote for lawn furniture over the current occupant of the Oval Office.
Well, that's what I mean. So the only mistake the Democrats can make is putting a person so unable to win the election that Trump wins again, right? And Biden can beat Trump. Kamala Harris can probably beat Trump. Some lawn furniture, the good stuff, could probably be Trump.
The chaise lounge.
But actually,
the Adirondack chairs, I don't know.
You know, shut my mouth because I think...
I was going to say, don't underestimate the passion that some people have for this presidency. And they'll say, I don't like what he says and I don't like the way he says it, but I really like his policies and the economy's doing better and I like his foreign policy, all that stuff. Unless it's somebody that really energizes Democrats, I think that is important.
And if I can warn our listeners, never, ever, ever, never, ever bet on politics against Patty Vasquez, because you will get waxed in public.
Is this true, Patty?
He had to have his left thigh, right armpit, and his back waxed.
And nostrils.
Live on there. And his nostrils. Yes.
What bet did he lose to you?
There were several. I mean, you don't do that to somebody just on one bet. Yeah.
We have three minutes left. I want to bounce some ideas and get your quick reaction to Democrats, all of them out there, churning out a lot of ideas. Free tuition and loan forgiveness. Patty, do you like the idea?
It's a nice idea. I don't think that it's practical.
Should we do that Scott?
I think it's a horrible idea.
Yeah, where are you?
I like free tuition on community colleges and so on.
That's a good
loan
idea.
Forgiveness.
Going forward, yeah.
Loan forgiveness. Yes, my first reaction to that is yes, because I think that student loan debt is crushing an entire generation of people. And I think
it's good. How about felons voting or people who are incarcerated being able to vote? Our Ro Khan on this radio station lost his mind over this. He said part of the punishment is you don't get to vote. I think that's artificial. It doesn't have to be that way. You can decide whatever you want the punishment to be. I think disenfranchising people who've committed crimes is un-American. It is unconstitutional in my mind.
It's all arbitrary, John. I mean, that's the thing. Imprisonment is arbitrary. No, they should not. No, they lose their rights for the time that they're incarcerated. I am totally in favor of once you've paid your debt, though, and you're out in society, then you're re-enfranchised and you get to vote.
How about you?
I have a compromise suggestion, which is that you allow people to vote if they're release date is within 8 years of the election.
Why 8 years?
Oh, I don't know. 5 years then. Some set amount of time. Because I'm not sure that you want like people who are in prison for life, because they're never going to be living out in society that their vote is helping to shape.
Using my tax dollars. Keep going.
Pardon me?
Keep going.
Okay. No, I'm saying that so that if given that they're going to be out there, the same logic applies to why we let 17-year-olds vote in primary elections if they're going to be 18 by the time the general election.
Oh, I see your point. Yeah.
So that this you're going to be reemerging into the society that your vote is helping to shape. So I would. So maybe that's a fun compromise.
Patty, go.
I feel like I have more questions than answers on this one. I mean, does someone lose their citizenship when they are incarcerated?
No.
And obviously they have a loss of freedom. There's still somebody who legislation, anything that's decided in government is going to affect them. So, like I said, I don't have an answer.
Should the Congress continue to pursue the president's income taxes, or
yes.
should the IRS release them?
Yes.
That's an easy one for the group.
Not really. I think it's a fishing expedition. I have a problem with that.
Yeah,
it's not a fishing expedition because it's like a lobster tank. It's not a fishing.
It's right there. You just want to grab it. Yeah. All right. Here's our last 30 seconds each. Go. I'll just call it a real act of self-awareness. Scott Walker tweeted a picture of himself this week wearing blue jeans and wrote, "In support of sexual assault victims, I'm wearing jeans on #DenimDay. Was Denim Day a thing, and were you supposed to call out a cause when you wore blue jeans and then posted them? And how can we tell the difference on Denim Day from people doing it for a cause and those who just are doing it because, you know, they're jeans? And Scott Walker, really?" Twitter noticed the oddness of all of this and wrote him pretty hard. Twitter's first reflex is to do that, but I think he shot himself in the jeans on this one. Eric Zorn, go.
Here is the plot. A vain nitwit is running for president, and a hostile foreign power is covertly aiding the campaign with the understanding that the idiot's victory will result in changes to U.S. foreign policy that will be advantageous to that country. In its seventh and final season, HBO's brilliantly funny sitcom Veep has never seemed more like a documentary. What started in 2012 as a jokey satire of Sarah Palin is wrapping up as an on-the-nose indictment of Donald Trump and Trumpism. Borrow someone's password if you must, but watch this show.
Scott Stanis, go.
Recent reports say that Social Security is about to run out of money, and they're going to dip into the $3 trillion trust fund. I think now is the time that we revisit George W. Bush's privatization plan that we all poo-pooed and scoffed at in the early 2000s.
We're out of time. Patty, you don't get to do yours. Bertrand is here. He's about to go live on WGN Radio. Patty, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Scott Stantis, Eric Zorn, I'm John Williams.
Before we go, can I just poo-poo and scoff Scott's
like
idea?
We're getting the rush here, Mr. Bertrand. Thank you, Olive Garris, for producing. I'm John. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.